She knew Jesper was well-armed and could take care of himself, but between his lanky frame and zemony skin, he was just too noticeable for comfort. They camped in a dry gully bordered by a tangle of shrubs and took shifts dozing on the hard rock ground and keeping watch. Despite her fatigue, Inej hadn't thought she would be able to sleep, but the next thing she knew, the sun was high above them, a bright pocket of glare in an overcast sky. It had to be past noon. Nina was beside her with a piece of one of the pepper wolf cookies she'd bought in Upper Jerholm. Inej saw that someone had made a low fire, and the sticky remnants of a block of melted paraffin were visible in the ashes. "Where are the others?" she asked, looking around the empty gully.
"In the road. Cass said we should let you sleep."
Inej rubbed her eyes. She supposed it was a concession to her injuries. Maybe she hadn't hidden her exhaustion well at all. A sudden crackling snap, snap, snap from the road had her on her feet with knives drawn in seconds.
"Easy," Nina said. "It's just Wylan."
Jesper must have already raised the signal. Inej took the cookie from Nina and hurried up to where Kaz and Matthias were watching Wylan fuss with something at the base of a thick red fir. Another series of pops sounded, and tiny puffs of white smoke burst from the tree's trunk where it met the ground. For a moment, it looked like nothing would happen. Then the roots loosed themselves from the soil, curling and withering.
"What was that?" asked Inej.
"Salt concentrate," said Nina.
Inej cocked her head to the side.
"Is Matthias praying?"
"Saying a blessing. Pierdens do it whenever they cut down a tree."
"Every time?"
"The blessing depends on how you intend to use the wood. One for houses, one for bridges."
She paused.
"One for kindling."
It took less than a minute for them to pull the tree down so that its trunk lay blocking the road. With its roots intact, it looked as if it had simply been felled by disease.
"Once the wagon stops, the tree will buy us about 15 minutes and not much more," Kaz said. "Move quickly. The prisoner should be hooded, but they'll be able to hear, so not a word. We can't afford to arouse suspicion. For all they know, this is a routine stop, and we want to keep it that way."
As Inej waited in the gully with the others, she considered all the things that might go wrong. The prisoners might not be wearing hoods. The guards might have one of their own in the back of the wagon. And if their crew succeeded? Well, then they'd be captives on their way into the ice court. That didn't seem like a particularly promising outcome either.
Just when she started to wonder if Jesper had been wrong and sent up the flare too early, a prison wagon rumbled into view. It rolled past them, then came to a halt in front of the tree.
She could hear the driver cursing to his companion. They both slid down from the box seat and made their way over to the tree. For a long minute, they stood there, staring at it. The larger guard took off his hat and scratched his belly.
"How lazy can they be?" Kaz muttered.
Finally, they seemed to accept that the tree wasn't going to move on its own. They strolled back to the wagon to retrieve a heavy coil of rope and unhitched one of the horses to help drag the tree out of the
road. "Be ready," Kaz
said. He skittered over the top of the gully to the back end of the cart. He'd left his walking stick behind in the ditch, and whatever pain he might have been feeling, he disguised it well. He slipped his lockpicks from the lining of his coat and cradled the padlock gently, almost lovingly. In seconds, it sprang open, and he shoved the bolt to the side. He glanced around to where the men were tying ropes around the tree, and then opened the door. Inej tensed, waiting for the signal. It didn't come. Kaz was just standing there, staring into the wagon.
"What's happening?" whispered Wylan.
"Maybe they aren't hooded," she replied.
From the side, she couldn't see.
"I'll go."
They couldn't all bunch up around the back of the cart at once. Inej climbed out of the gully and came up behind Kaz. He was still standing there, perfectly still. She touched his shoulder briefly, and he flinched. Kaz Brekker flinched? What was going on? She couldn't ask him and risk giving anything away to the listening prisoners. She peered into the wagon.
The prisoners were all cuffed and had black sacks over their heads, but there were considerably more of them than in the wagon they'd seen at the checkpoint. Instead of being seated and chained to the benches at the sides, they were standing, pressed up against one another. Their feet and hands had been shackled, and they all wore iron collars that had been clipped to hooks in the wagon's roof. Whenever one started to slump or lean too heavily, his or her breath would be cut off. It wasn't pretty, but they were so tightly packed together it didn't look like anyone could actually fall and choke. Inej gave Kaz another little nudge. His face was pale, almost waxen, but at least this time he didn't just stand there. He pushed himself up into the wagon, his movements jerky and awkward, and began unlocking the prisoners' collars. Inej signaled to Matthias, who leapt out of the gully to join them.
"What's happening?"
one of the prisoners asked in Ravkin, his voice frightened.
"Teeg,"
Matthias growled, harshly in Fjärden. A rustle went through the prisoners in the truck, as if they were all coming to attention. Without meaning to, Inej had straightened her spine, too. With that word, Matthias's whole demeanor had changed, as if with a single sharp command, he'd stepped back into the uniform of a Druzkala. Inej eyed him nervously. She'd started to feel comfortable with Matthias, an easy habit to fall into, but unwise. Kaz unlocked 6 sets of hands and foot shackles. One by one, Inej and Matthias unloaded the 6 prisoners closest to the door. There wasn't time to consider height or build or even if they'd freed men or women. They led them to the edge of the gully, all while keeping an eye on the progress of the guards on the road.
"What's happening?"
one of the captives dared to ask, but another quick "dig" from Matthias silenced him. Once they were out of view, Nina dropped their pulses, sending them into unconsciousness. Only then did Weiland remove the prisoners' hoods. 4 men, one of them quite old, a middle-aged woman, and a shoe boy. It definitely wasn't ideal, but hopefully the guards wouldn't fret too much over accuracy. After all, how much trouble could a group of chained and shackled convicts be? Nina injected the prisoners with a sleeping solution to prolong their rest, and Weiland helped roll them into the gully behind the trees.
"Are we just going to leave them there?"
Weiland whispered to Inej as they hurried back to the wagon with the prisoners' hoods in hand. Inej's eyes were trained on the guards moving the tree, and she didn't look at him when she said, "They'll wake soon enough and make a run for it. They might even get to the coast in freedom. We're doing them a favor."
"It doesn't look like a favor. It looks like leaving them in a ditch."
"Quiet," she ordered. This wasn't the time or the place for moral quibbling. If Weiland didn't know the difference between being in chains and out of them, he was about to find out. Inej cupped her hand to her mouth and gave a low, soft bird call. They had 4, maybe 5 minutes left before the guards cleared the road. Thankfully, the guards were raising quite a noise, shouting encouragement at the horse and yelling to one another. Matthias locked Weiland into place first, then Nina. Inej saw him stiffen as Nina lifted her hair to accept the collar, revealing the white curve of her neck. As he fastened it around her throat, Nina met his eyes over her shoulder, and the look they exchanged could have melted miles of northern ice. Matthias moved away, hurriedly. Inej almost laughed. So that was all it took to send the Druzkala scurrying and bring the boy back. Jesper was next, panting from his run back to the crossroads. He winked at her as she placed the sack over his head. They could hear the guards calling back and forth. Inej locked Matthias' collar and stood on tiptoe to place the hood on his head. But when she moved to pull Nina's hood down, the Grisha fluttered her eyes rapidly, bobbing her head toward the wagon door. She still wanted to know how Kaz was going to lock them in.
"Watch,"
Inez mouthed. Kaz signaled to Inej and she leapt down. She shut the wagon door, fastened the padlock, and slid the bolt home. A second later, the opposite side of the door pushed open. Kaz had simply removed the hinges. It was a trick they'd used plenty of times when a lock was too complicated to pick quickly or they wanted to make a theft look like an inside job.
"Ideal for faking suicides,"
Kaz had once told her. And she'd never been sure if he was sincere. Inej took a last look at the road. The man had finished with the tree. The big one was dusting off his hands and slapping the horse's back. The other was already approaching the front of the wagon. Inej gripped the lip of the door and swung herself up, squeezing inside. Immediately, Kaz started replacing the hinges. Inej shoved a hood over Nina's surprised face, then took her place beside Jesper. But even in the dim light, she could tell Kaz was moving too slowly, his gloved fingers clumsier than she'd ever seen them. What was wrong with him? And why had he frozen at the wagon door? Something had made him hesitate. But what? She heard the ping of metal as Kaz dropped one of the screws. She peered at the wagon floor and kicked it back to him, trying to ignore the pounding of her heart. Kaz crouched down to replace the second hinge. He was breathing hard. She knew he was working in low light by touch alone in those cursed leather gloves he always insisted on wearing, but Inej didn't think that was why he seemed so agitated. She heard footsteps on the right side of the wagon, one guard shouting to another, "Come on, Kaz." She hadn't taken the time to sweep away their footprints. What if the guard noticed? What if he pulled on the door and it simply fell off its hinges, revealing Kaz Brekker, unhooded and unchained? She heard another ping. Kaz cursed once under his breath. Suddenly the door shook as the guard gave the chained padlock a rattle. Kaz braced his hand against the hinge. The crack of light beneath the door widened. Inej sucked in a breath. The hinges held. Another shout in Fjärden, more footsteps. Then the crack of the reins and the cart surged forward, rumbling over the road. Inej let herself exhale. Her throat had gone completely dry. Kaz took his place beside her. He shoved a hood over her head and the musty smell filled her nostrils. He would put his own hood on next, then lock himself in. Easy enough, a cheap magician's trick, and Kaz knew them all. His arm pressed along hers from shoulder to elbow as he locked the collar around his neck. Body shifted against Inej's back and sighed, crowding up against her. For now they were safe, but despite the rattle of the wagon's wheels, Inej could tell Kaz's breathing had gotten worse, shallow, rapid pants like an animal caught in a trap. It was a sound she'd never thought to hear from him. It was because she was listening so closely that she knew the exact moment when Kaz Brekker, Dirty Hands, the Bastard of the Barrel, and the deadliest boy in Ketterdam, fainted.
22. Kaz. The money Mr. Hertzoon had left with Kaz and Jordy ran out the following week. Jordy tried to return his new coat, but the shop wouldn't take it, and Kaz's boots had clearly been worn. When they brought the loan agreement Mr. Hertzoon had signed to the bank, they found that, for all its official-looking seals, it was worthless paper. No one knew of Mr. Hertzoon or his business partner. They were evicted from the boarding house 2 days later and had to find a bridge to sleep under, but were soon rousted by the stopwatch. After that, they wandered aimlessly until morning. Jordy insisted that they go back to the coffee house. They sat for a long time in the park across the street, but when night came, the watch began its rounds, and Kaz and Jordy headed south into the streets of the Lower Barrel, where the police did not bother to patrol. They slept beneath a set of stairs in an alley behind a tavern, tucked between a discarded stove and bags of kitchen refuse. No one bothered them that night. But the next, they were discovered by a gang of boys who told them they were in Razor Gull territory. They gave Jordy a thrashing and knocked Kaz into the canal, but not before they took his boots. Jordy fished Kaz out of the water and gave him his dry coat. "I'm hungry," Kaz said. "I'm not," Jordy replied, and for some reason that had struck Kaz as funny. And they both started laughing. Jordy wrapped his arms around Kaz and said, "The city's winning so far, but you'll see who wins in the end." The next morning, Jordy woke with a fever. In years to come, people would call the outbreak of firepox that struck Ketterdam the Queen's Lady Plague. After the ship believed to have brought the contagion to the city, it hit the crowded slums of the Barrel hardest, bodies piled up in the streets, and sick boats moved through the canals, using long shovels and hooks to tumble corpses onto their platforms and haul them out to the Reaper's barge for burning. Kaz's fever came on 2 days after Jordy's. They had no money for medicine or a medic, so they huddled together in a pile of broken-up wooden boxes that they dubbed the Nest. No one came to roust them. The gangs had all been laid low by disease. When the fever reached full fire, Kaz dreamed he had returned to the farm. And when he knocked on the door, he saw Dream Jordy and Dream Kaz already there, sitting at the kitchen table. They peered at him through the window, but they wouldn't let him in. So he wandered through the meadow, afraid to lie down in the tall grass. When he woke, he couldn't smell hay or clover or apples, only coal smoke and the spongy, rotting vegetable stink of garbage. Jordy was lying next to him, staring at the sky. "Don't leave me," Kaz wanted to say, but he was too tired, so he laid his head on Jordy's chest. It felt wrong already, cold and hard. He thought he was dreaming when the body men rolled him onto the sick boat. He felt himself falling, and then he was caught in a tangle of bodies. He tried to scream, but he was too weak. They were everywhere, legs and arms and stiff bellies, rotting limbs and blue-lipped faces covered in firepox sores. He floated in and out of consciousness, unsure of what was real or fever dream, as the flatboat moved out to sea. When they tumbled him into the shallows of the Reaper's barge, he somehow found the strength to cry out, "I'm alive!" he shouted, as loud as he could, but he was so small and the boat was already drifting back to harbor. Kaz tried to pull Jordy from the water. His body was covered in the little blooming sores that gave the firepox its name, his skin white and bruised. Kaz thought of the little wind-up dog, of drinking hot chocolate on the bridge. He thought that heaven would look like the kitchen of the house on Zelverstraat and smell like Hotspot cooking in the Hertzun's oven. He still had Saskia's red ribbon. He could give it back to her. They would make candles out of the quince paste. Margit would play the piano, and he could fall asleep by the fire. He closed his eyes and waited to die. Kaz expected to wake in the next world, warm and safe, his belly full, Jordy beside him. Instead, he woke surrounded by corpses. He was lying in the shallows of the Reaper's barge, his clothes soaked through, skin wrinkled from the damp. Jordy's body was beside him, barely recognizable. White and swollen with rot, floating on the surface like some kind of gruesome deep-sea fish. Kaz's vision had cleared and the rash had receded. His fever had broken. He'd forgotten his hunger, but he was thirsty enough that he thought he would go mad. All that day and night he waited in the pile of bodies, looking out at the harbor, hoping the flat boat would return. They had to come to set the fires that would burn the corpses. But when? Did the body men collect every day? Every other day? He was weak and dehydrated. He knew he wouldn't last much longer. The coast seemed so far away, and he knew he was too weak to swim the distance. He had survived the fever, but he might well die out here on the Reaper's barge. Did he care? There's nothing waiting for him in the city but more hunger and dark alleys and the damp of the canals. Even as he thought it, he knew it wasn't true. Vengeance was waiting. Vengeance for Jordy, and maybe for himself, too. But he would have to go to meet it. When night came, the tide changed direction. Kaz forced himself to lay hands on Jordy's body. He was too frail to swim on his own, but with Jordy's help, he could float. He held tight to his brother and kicked toward the lights of Ketterdam. Together they drifted, Jordy's distended body acting as a raft. Kaz kept kicking, trying not to think of his brother, of the taut, bloated feel of Jordy's flesh beneath his hands. He tried not to think of anything but the rhythm of his legs moving through the sea. He'd heard there were sharks in these waters, but he knew they wouldn't touch him. He was a monster now, too. He kept kicking, and when dawn came, he looked up to find himself at the east end of the lid. The harbor was nearly deserted. The plague had caused shipping in and out of Kerch to grind to a halt. The last 100 yards were hard. The tide had turned once more, and it was working against him. But Kaz had hope now, hope and fury, twin flames burning inside him. They guided him to the dock and up the ladder. When he reached the top, he flopped down on his back on the wooden slats, then forced himself to roll over. Geordi's body was caught in the current, bumping against the pylon below. His eyes were still open, and for a moment Kaz thought his brother was staring back at him. But Geordi didn't speak. He didn't blink. His gaze didn't shift as the tide dragged him free of the pylon and began to carry him out to sea. "I should close his eyes," thought Kaz. But he knew if he climbed down the ladder and waded back into the sea, he would never find his way out again. He'd simply let himself drown, and that wasn't possible anymore. He had to live. Someone had to pay. In the prison wagon, Kaz woke to a sharp jab against his thigh. He was ice cold and in darkness. There were bodies all around him, pressing against his back, his sides. He was drowning in corpses. "Kaz!" A whisper. He shuddered. Another jab to his thigh. "Kaz!" Inej's voice. He managed a deep breath through his nose. He felt her pull away from him. Somehow, in the cramped confines of the wagon, she managed to give him space. His heart was pounding. "Keep talking," he rasped. "What?" "Just keep talking." "We're passing through the prison gate. We made it past the first two checkpoints." That brought him fully to his senses. They'd gone through two checkpoints. That meant they'd been counted. Someone had opened that door. Not once, but twice. Maybe even laid hands on him, and he hadn't woken. He could have been robbed, killed. He'd imagined his death 1,000 ways, but never sleeping through it. He forced himself to breathe deeply, despite the smell of bodies. He kept his gloves on, something the guards might have easily taken note of, and a frustrating concession to his weakness. But if he hadn't, he felt fairly sure he'd have gone completely mad. Behind him, he could hear the other prisoners murmuring to one another in different languages. Despite the fears the darkness woke in him, he gave thanks for it. He could only hope that the rest of the crew, hooded and burdened by their own anxiety, hadn't noticed anything strange about his behavior. He'd been sluggish, slow to react when they'd ambushed the wagon, but that was all. He could make up some excuse to account for it. He hated that Inej had seen him this way, and anyone had, but on the heels of that thought came another. Better it should be her. In his bones, he knew that she would never speak of it to anyone, as she would never use this knowledge against him. She relied on his reputation. She wouldn't want him to look weak. But there was more to it than that, wasn't there? Inej would never betray him, he knew it. Kaz felt ill. Though he'd trusted her with his life countless times, it felt much more frightening to trust her with his shame. The wagon came to a halt, the bolt slid back, and the doors flew open. He heard Fjordan being spoken, then scraping noises and a thunk. His collar was unlocked, and he was led from the wagon down some kind of ramp with the other prisoners. He heard what sounded like a gate creaking open, and they were herded forward, shuffling along in their shackles. He squinted as his hood was suddenly yanked free. They were standing in a large courtyard. The massive gate set into the ring wall was already being lowered closed, and it struck the stones with an ominous series of clanks and groans. When Kaz looked up, he saw guards stationed all along the roof of the courtyard, rifles aimed down at the prisoners. The guards below were moving along the rows of shackled captives, trying to match them to the driver's paperwork by name or description. Matthias had described the layout of the ice court in detail, but he'd said little about the way it actually looked. Kaz had expected something old and damp, grim gray stone, battle-hard. Instead, he was surrounded by marble, so white it almost glowed blue. He felt as if he'd wandered into some dreamlike version of the harsh lands they'd traveled in the north. It was impossible to tell what might be glass or ice or stone. "If this isn't fabricator craft, then I'm the queen of the wood sprites," muttered Nina in Kerch.
"Tig!" one of the guards commanded. He slammed his rifle into her gut, and she doubled over in pain. Matthias kept his head turned, but Kaz didn't miss the tension in his frame. The Fjorden guards were gesturing over their papers, trying to make the numbers and identities of the prisoners match up to the group before them. This was the first real moment of exposure, one Kaz would have no control over. It would have been too time-consuming and dangerous to pick and choose the prisoners they'd replaced. It was a calculated risk, but now Kaz could only wait and hope that laziness and bureaucracy would do the rest. As the guards moved down the line, Inej helped Nina to her feet.
"You okay?"
Inej asked, and Kaz felt himself drawn toward her voice like water rolling downhill. Slowly, Nina unbent herself and stood upright.
"I'm fine," she whispered, "but I don't think we have to worry about Becca Rollins' team anymore."
Kaz tracked Nina's gaze to the top of the ring wall, high above the courtyard, where five men had been impaled on spikes like meat skewered for roasting, backs bent, limbs dangling. Kaz had to squint, but he recognized Errol Ertz, Rollins' best lockpick and safecracker. The bruises and welts from the beating they'd given him before his death were deep purple in the morning light. And Kaz could just make out a black mark on his arm. Ertz Dime Lion tattoo. He scanned the other faces. Some were too swollen and distorted in death to identify. Could one of them be Rollins? Kaz knew he should be glad another team had been taken out. But Rollins was no fool, and the thought that his crew hadn't made it past the ice court gates was more than a little nerve-wracking. Besides, if Rollins had met his death at the end of a Fjorden pike? No, Kaz refused that possibility. Becca Rollins belonged to him. The guards were arguing with the wagon driver now, and one of them was pointing to Inej.
"What's happening?" he whispered to Nina. "They're claiming the papers are out of order, that they have a Suli girl instead of a shoe boy." "And the driver?" asked Inej. "He just keeps telling them it's not his problem."
"That's the way," Kaz murmured encouragingly. Kaz watched them go back and forth. That was the beauty of all these fail-safes and layers of security. The guards always thought they could rely on someone else to catch a mistake or fix a problem. Laziness wasn't as reliable as greed, but it still made a fine lever. And they were talking about prisoners, chained, surrounded on all sides, and about to be dumped into cells. Harmless. Finally, one of the prison guards sighed and signaled to his cohorts.
"Divest him in!"
"Go on," Nina translated, and then continued as the guard spoke. "Take them to the east block and let the next shift sort them out."
Kaz allowed himself the briefest sigh of relief. As anticipated, guards split the group into men and women, then led both rows, chains jangling through a nearly round archway fashioned in the shape of a wolf's open mouth. They entered a chamber where an old woman sat with her hands chained, flanked by guards. Her eyes were vacant. As each prisoner approached, the woman gripped his or her wrist. A human amplifier. Kaz knew Nina had worked with them when she'd been scouring the wandering aisle for Grisha to join the Second Army. They could sense Grisha power by touch, and he'd seen them hired on at high-stakes card games to make sure none of the players were Grisha.
Someone who could tamper with another player's pulse or even raise the temperature in a room had an unfair advantage. But the Fjordans used them for a different purpose. To make sure no Grisha breached their walls without being identified. Kaz watched Nina approach. He could see her trembling as she held out her arm. The woman clamped her fingers around Nina's wrist. Her eyelids stuttered briefly. Then she dropped Nina's hand and waved her along. Had she known and not cared? Or had the paraffin they'd used to encase Nina's forearm worked? As they were led through an arch on the left, Kaz glimpsed Inej disappearing into the opposite arch with the other female prisoners. He felt a twinge in his chest, and with a disturbing jolt he realized it was panic. She'd been the one to wake him from his stupor in the cart. Her voice had brought him back from the dark. It had been the tether he gripped and used to drag himself back to some semblance of sanity. The male prisoners were led clanking up a dark flight of stairs to a metal walkway. On their left was the smooth white bulk of the ring wall. To their right, the walkway overlooked a vast glass enclosure, nearly a quarter mile long and tall enough to comfortably fit a trading ship. It was lit by a huge iron lantern that hung from the ceiling like a glowing cocoon. Looking down, Kaz saw rows of heavily armored wagons capped by domed gun turrets. Their wheels were large and linked by a thick tread, and each wagon a massive gun barrel, somewhere between the shape of a rifle and a cannon, jutted out into the space where a team of horses would ordinarily be hitched. "What are those things?" he whispered. "Thorvegan," Matthias said under his breath. "They don't need horses to pull them. They were still perfecting the design when I left." "No horses." "Tanks," murmured Jesper. "I saw prototypes when I was working with a gunsmith in Novia Zem. Multiple guns in the turret. And that big barrel out in front? Serious firepower." There's also gravity-fed heavy artillery guns in the enclosure. Racks full of rifles, ammunition, and the little black bombs that Ravkans called granatje. On the walls behind the glass, older weapons had been arranged in an elaborate display. Axes, spears, longbows. Above it all hung a banner in silver and white. Streimarket, Fjorden. When Kaz glanced at Matthias, the big man muttered, "Fjorden might." Kaz peered through the thick glass. He knew defenses, and Nina had been right. This glass was another piece of fabricator work, bulletproof and impenetrable. Coming or going from the prison, captives would see weapons, armaments, machines of war, all a brutal reminder of the power of the Fjorden state. "Go on and flex," Kaz thought. "Doesn't matter how big the gun is, if you don't know where to point it." On the other side of the enclosure, he saw a second walkway, where the female prisoners were being marched. Inej will be fine. He had to stay sharp. They were in enemy territory now, a place of steep risk, the kind of fix you didn't walk out of if you didn't keep your wits about you. Had Pekka's team made it this far before they'd been found out? And where was Pekka Rollins himself? Had he stayed safe and secure in Kirch, or was he a prisoner of the Fjordans as well? None of it mattered. For now, Kaz had to focus on the plan and finding Yule by Yule. He glanced at the others. Wieland looked like he was ready to wet himself. Helvar appeared grim as always. Jesper just grinned and whispered, "Well, we've managed to get ourselves locked into the most secure prison in the world. We're either geniuses or the dumbest sons of bitches to ever breathe air. We'll know soon enough." They were led into another white room, this one equipped with tin tubs and hoses. The guards gabbled something in Fjorden, and Kaz saw Matthias and some of the others start to strip down. He swallowed the bile that rose in his throat. He refused to vomit. He could do this. He had to do this. He thought of Jordi. What would Jordi say if his little brother lost their chance at justice because he couldn't conquer some stupid sickness inside him? But it only brought back the memory of Jordi's cold flesh. The way it had grown loose in the salt water, the bodies crowding around him in the flatboat. His vision started to blur.
Get it together, Brecker.
He scolded himself harshly. It didn't help. He was going to faint again, and this would all be over. Inej had once offered to teach him how to fall.
The trick is not getting knocked down, he told her with a laugh.
No, Kaz, she'd said. The trick is in getting back up.
More Sully platitudes, but somehow even the memory of her voice helped.
He was better than this. He had to be. Not just for Geordi, but for his crew. He brought these people here. He brought Inej here. It was his job to bring them out again. The trick is getting back up. He kept her voice in his head, repeating those words again and again as he stripped off his boots, his clothes, and finally his gloves. He saw that Jesper was staring at his hands.
What were you expecting? Kaz growled.
Claws, at least, Jesper said, shifting his gaze to his own bony, bare feet. Possibly a spiny thumb.
The guard returned from dumping their clothes in a bin that would no doubt be taken to the incinerator. He tilted Kaz's head back roughly and forced his mouth open, feeling around with fat fingers. Black spots bloomed in Kaz's sight as he fought to remain conscious. The guard's fingers passed over the spot between Kaz's teeth where he'd wedged the baleen, then pinched and prodded the interior of his cheeks.
Angatjarn! The guard exclaimed. Felin Yurit!
He shouted again as he pulled two slender pieces of metal from Kaz's mouth. The lockpicks hit the stone floor with a plink, plink. The guard shouted something at him in Fjordan and cuffed him hard across the face. Kaz fell to his knees but forced himself back up. He registered Weiland's panicked expression, but it was all he could do to stay on his feet as the guard shoved him into line for an ice-cold shower. When he emerged, soaked and shaking, another guard handed him colorless, prison-issue trousers and a tunic from the stack beside him. Kaz pulled them on, then limped to the holding area with the rest of the prisoners. In that moment, he would have given up half his shares of the 30 million Kruger for the familiar heft of his cane. The holding cells looked much more like the prison he had anticipated. No white stone or glass displays, just dank gray rock and iron bars. They were herded into an already crowded cell. Helvar sat down with his back to the wall, surveying the pacing men, eyes slitted. Kaz rested against the iron bars, watching the guards depart. He could sense the movements of the bodies behind him. There was space enough, but they still felt too close. Just a little longer, Kaz told himself. His hands felt impossibly bare. Kaz waited. He knew what was coming. He'd sussed out the others as soon as they entered the cell, and he knew it would be the burly Kalish with the birthmark who came for him. He was twitchy, nervous, and he'd taken obvious notice of Kaz's limp.
"Hey, cripple,"
the Kalish said in Fjordan. He tried again in Kirch, his lilt heavy.
"Hey, crip."
He needn't have bothered. Kaz knew the word for cripple in plenty of languages. The next second, Kaz felt the air move as the Kalish reached for him. He stepped left, and the Kalish lurched forward, carried by his own momentum. Kaz helped him along, seizing the man's arm and driving it through the space between bars all the way up to the shoulder. The Kalish let out a loud grunt as his face smashed up against the iron bars. Kaz braced the man's forearm against the metal. He threw his weight against his opponent's body and felt a satisfying pop as the Kalish's arm dislocated from his shoulder. As the man opened his lips to scream, Kaz covered his mouth with one hand and pinched his nose shut with the other. The feel of bare flesh on his fingers made him want to gag. "Shh," he said, using his grip on the man's nose to steer him backward to the bench against the wall. The other prisoners scattered to clear a path. The man sat down hard, eyes watering, breathless.
Kaz kept his hold on his nose and mouth. The Kalish trembled beneath his grasp.
You want me to put it back? Kaz asked.
The Kalish whimpered.
Do you?
He whimpered louder as the prisoners looked on.
You scream? And I'll make sure it never works right again, understand?
He released the man's mouth and shoved his arm back into its socket. The Kalish rolled over on his side, curled up on the bench, and began to weep. Kaz wiped his hands on his trousers and returned to his spot by the bars. He could feel the others watching, but now he knew he would be left in peace. Helvar came up beside him. Was that really necessary?
No.
But it had been. To make sure they were left alone to do what needed to be done, and to remember that he wasn't helpless.
23. Jesper. Jesper wanted to pace, but he'd staked out his spot on the bench, and he intended to keep it. It felt like little quakes of anxiety and excitement were vibrating under his skin, and Wylan, seated next to him, drumming frenetically on his kneecaps, wasn't helping him settle. He didn't think he could handle much more waiting. First the boat, then all that hiking. And now he was stuck in a cell until the guards came by to make their evening headcount. Only his father had understood his restless energy. He'd tried to get Jesper to use it up on the farm, but the work had been too monotonous. University was supposed to be the thing that gave him direction, but instead, he'd wandered down a different path. He cringed at what his father would say if he learned his son had died in a Fjerdan prison. But how would he ever know? That was too depressing to dwell on. How much time had passed? What if they couldn't even hear the elder clock in here? The guards were supposed to make the head count at 6 bells. Then Jesper and the others would have until midnight to get the job done, they hoped. Matthias had only spent 3 months at the prison. Protocols could have changed. He might have gotten something wrong, or maybe the Fjerdan just wants us behind bars before he rats us out. But Matthias was sitting silent on the far side of the cell near Kaz. Jesper hadn't been able to miss Kaz's little skirmish with the Kalish. Kaz was usually unshakable during a job, but now he was on edge, and Jesper didn't know why. Part of him wanted to ask, but he knew that was the stupid part. The hopeful farm boy who picked the worst possible person to care about, who searched for signs in things that he knew, deep down, meant nothing. When Kaz chose him for a job, when Kaz played along with one of his jokes, he could have kicked himself. He'd finally seen the infamous Kaz Brekker without a stitch of clothing, and he'd been too worried about ending up on a pike to pay proper attention. If Jesper was anxious, Wylan looked like he might actually throw up. "What are we supposed to do now?" Wylan whispered. What good is a lockpick without his picks? Be quiet. And what good are you? A sharpshooter without his guns? You're completely extraneous to this mission. It's not a mission, it's a job. Matthias calls it a mission. He's military, you're not. And I'm already in jail, so don't tempt me to commit homicide. You aren't going to kill me. And I'm not going to pretend everything is okay. We're stuck in here. You're definitely better suited to a gilded cage than to a real one. I left my father's house. Yeah. You gave up a life of luxury so you could come slum it with us sobs in the barrel. That doesn't make you interesting, Wylan. Just stupid. You don't know anything about it. So tell me, Jesper said, turning to him. We have time. What makes a good little merch boy leave home to keep company with criminals? You act like you were born in the barrel like Kaz. But you're not even Kirch. You chose this life, too. I like cities. They don't have cities in Novia Zem? Not like Ketterdam. Have you ever even been anywhere but home? The barrel? and fancy embassy dinners? Weiland looked away. Yes. Where? The suburbs for peach season? The races at Karieva, the Shu oil fields, the Gerda farms near Shriftport, Weddell, Elling.
Really?
My father used to take me everywhere with him.
Until?
Until what?
Until my father took me everywhere, until I contracted terrible seasickness. Until I vomited at a royal wedding, until I tried to hump the ambassador's leg.
The leg was asking for it.
Jesper released a bark of laughter. Finally, a little spine.
I have plenty of spine, Weiland grumbled.
And look where it got.
He was interrupted by a guard's voice shouting in Fjerdin, just as the elder clock began to chime 6 bells.
At least the Fjerdins were punctual.
The guard spoke again in Shu, and then in Kirch.
On your feet.
Shimkopper, the guard demanded.
They all looked at him blankly.
The piss bucket, he tried in Kirch.
Where is to empty, he pantomimed.
There were shrugs and confused glances.
The guard's gloomy sulk made it clear he couldn't care less. He shoved a bucket of fresh water into the cell and slammed the bars shut.
Jesper pushed to the front and took a big gulp from the cup tied to its handle. Most of it splashed on his shirt. When he handed the cup to Weiland, he made sure it soaked him as well.
What are you doing? Weiland protested.
Patience, Weiland, and do try to follow along.
Jesper hiked up his pants and felt around the thin skin over his ankle.
Tell me, what's happened?
Be quiet. I need to concentrate.
It was true. He really didn't want the pellet buried beneath his skin to open up while it was still inside him. He felt along the thin stitches Nina had placed there. It hurt like hell when he popped them open and slid the pellet out. It was about the size of a raisin and slick with his blood. Nina would be using her powers to split open her own skin right now.
Jesper wondered if it hurt any less than the stitches.
Pull your shirt up over your mouth, he told Weiland.
What?
Stop being dense. You're cuter when you're smart. Weiland's cheeks went pink. He scowled and pulled his collar up.
Jesper reached under the bench where he'd hidden the waste bucket and pulled it out.
A storm's coming, Jesper said loudly in Kirch. He saw Matthias and Kaz draw their collars up. He turned his face away, pulled his shirt over his mouth, and dropped the pellet into the bucket.
There was a sizzling whoosh as a cloud of mist bloomed from the water.
In seconds, it had blanketed the cells, turning the air a milky green.
Weiland's eyes were panicked above his hiked-up collar.
Jesper was tempted to pretend to faint, but he settled for the effect of men toppling to the ground all around him.
Jesper waited for a count of 60, then dropped his collar and took a tentative breath.
The air still smelled sickly sweet and would leave them woozy for a bit, but the worst of it had dispersed. When the guards came through for the next head count, the prisoners would have bad headaches, but not much to tell. And hopefully, by then, they'd be long gone.
Was that chlorogas?
Definitely cuter when you're smart.
Yes.
The pellet's an enzyme-based casing filled with chloro powder. It's harmless unless it comes into contact with any amount of ammonia, which it just did.
The urine in the bucket? But what was the point? We're still stuck in here.
Jesper, Kaz said, waving him over to the bars. The clock is ticking.
Jesper rolled his shoulders as he approached.
This kind of work usually took a lot of time, particularly because he'd never had real training. He placed his hands on either side of a single bar and concentrated on locating the purest particles of ore.
What is he doing? Asked Matthias.
Performing an ancient Zemini ritual, Kaz said.
Really?
No.
A murky haze was forming between Jesper's hands.
Weiland gasped.
Is that iron ore? Jesper nodded as he felt sweat break out on his brow. Can you dissolve the bars? Don't be an idiot, Jesper grunted. Do you see how thick they are? In fact, the bar he was working on looked unchanged, but he'd pulled enough iron from it that the cloud between his hands was nearly black. He bent his fingertips, and the particles spun, whirring into a tightening spiral that grew narrower and denser. Jesper dropped his hands, and a slender needle fell to the floor with a musical ping. Weiland snatched it up, holding it so the light gleamed over its dull surface. You're a fabricator, Matthias said grimly. Just barely. You either are or you aren't, said Weiland. I am. He jabbed a finger at Weiland. And you're going to keep your mouth shut about it when we get back to Ketterdom. But why would you lie about, I like walking the streets free, said Jesper. I like not worrying about being snatched up by a slaver or put to death by some skiv like our friend Helvar here. Besides, I have other skills that bring me more pleasure and profit than this. Lots of other skills. Weiland coughed. Flirting with him might actually be more fun than annoying him. But it was a close call. Does Nina know you're Grisha? No, and she's not finding out. I don't need lectures about joining the Second Army and the glorious Ravkin cause. Do it again, Kaz interrupted, and hurry. Jesper repeated his effort on another bar. If this was the plan, what was the point to trying to smuggle in those lockpicks? Weiland asked. Kaz folded his arms. Ever hear about the dying man whose medic told him he'd been miraculously cured? He danced into the street and was trampled to death by a horse. You have to let the mark feel like he's won. Were the guards studying Matthias and wondering if he looked familiar? Were they looking for trouble when Jesper went into the showers with paraffin sloughing off his arms? No, they were too busy congratulating themselves on catching me. They thought they'd neutralize the threat. When Jesper finished, Kaz took the two slender lockpicks between his fingers. It was strange to see him work without his gloves, but in moments, the lock clicked open and they were free. Once they were out, Kaz used his picks to lock the door behind them. You know your assignments, he whispered. Weiland and I will get Nina and Inej out. Jesper, you and Matthias, I know. Nab as much rope as we can find. Be in the basement by the half chime. They split. The wheels were in motion. According to Weiland's plans, the stables were adjacent to the gatehouse courtyard, so they would have to backtrack through the holding area. In theory, this section of the prison was only supposed to be active when prisoners were being processed in or out, but they still had to be careful. It would only take one wayward guard to ruin their plans. The scariest part was traversing the walkway through the glass enclosure, a long, brightly lit stretch that left them completely exposed. There was nothing to do but cross their fingers and make a run for it. Then they headed down the stairs and to the left of the chamber where that old, poor Grisha amplifier had tested him. Jesper suppressed a shudder. Even though paraffin on his arms always worked at the gambling dens, his heart had still been hammering as he faced her. She'd been thin as a husk and as empty. That was what happened to Grisha, who got found in the wrong place at the wrong time. A life sentence of slavery or worse. When Jesper pushed open the door to the stables, he felt some small thing inside him relax. The smell of hay, the shift of animals in their stalls, the nickering of the horses brought back memories of Novia Zim. In Ketterdom, the canals rendered most coaches and wagons unnecessary. Horses were a luxury, an indulgence to show that you had the space to keep them and the wealth to care for them. He hadn't realized how much he missed simply being around animals. But there was no time for nostalgia or to stop and stroke a velvety nose. He strode past the stalls and into the tack room. Matthias hoisted a massive coil of rope over each shoulder. He looked surprised when Jesper managed to as well. Grew up on a farm, Jesper explained. You don't look it. Sure, I'm skinny, he said as they hurried back through the stables. But I stay drier in the rain. How? Less falls on me. Are all of Kaz's associates as strange as this crew? Matthias asked. Oh, you should meet the rest of the dregs. They make us look like Fjerdens. They passed through the showers and, instead of continuing to the holding area, turned down a tight flight of stairs and the long, dark hall that led to the basement. They were under the main prison now. 5 stories of cell block, prisoners, and guards stacked on top of them. Jesper had expected the rest of the crew to be collecting demo supplies in the big laundry room already. But all he saw were giant tin tubs, long tables for folding, and clothes left to dry overnight on racks taller than he was. They found Wylan and Inej in the refuse room. It was smaller than the laundry and stank of garbage. 2 big rolling bins full of discarded clothes were pushed against one wall, waiting to be burnt. Jesper felt the heat emanating from the incinerator as soon as they entered. We have a problem, Wylan said. How bad? Jesper asked, dumping his coils of rope on the floor. Inez gestured to a pair of big metal doors set into what looked like a giant chimney that jutted out from the wall and stretched all the way up to the ceiling. I think they ran the incinerator this afternoon. You said they ran it in the mornings, he said to Matthias. They used to. When Jesper grabbed the door's leather-covered handles and pulled them open, he was hit by a blast of searing air. It carried the black and acrid smell of coal and something else, a chemical smell. Maybe something they added to make the fires burn hotter. It wasn't unpleasant. This was where all the refuse from the prisons was disposed of. Kitchen leavings, buckets of human filth, the clothing stripped from prisoners. But whatever the Fjerdens had added to the fuel burned hot enough to sear any foulness away. He leaned in, already beginning to sweat. Far below, he saw the incinerator coals, banked, but still pulsing with an angry red glow. Wylan, give me a shirt from one of the bins, Jesper said. He tore off one of the sleeves and tossed it into the shaft. It fell, soundlessly, caught a flame mid-air, and had begun to burn away to nothing before it ever had the chance to reach the coals. He shut the doors and tossed the remnants of the shirt back in the bin. Well, demo is out, he said. We can't take explosives in there. Can you still make the climb? He asked Inej. Maybe. I don't know. What does Kaz say? Where is Kaz, and where's Nina? Kaz doesn't know about the incinerator yet, said Inej. He and Nina went to search the upper cells. Matthias's glower went dark as a rain-heavy sky ready to split. Jesper and I were supposed to go with Nina. Kaz didn't want to wait. We were on time, said Matthias angrily. What is he up to? Jesper wondered the same thing. He's going to limp up and down all those flights of stairs, dodging patrols? I may have tried to point that out to him, Inez said. Always surprising, remember? Like a hive of bees. I really hope we're not all about to get stung. Inej, Wylan called from one of the rolling bins. These are our clothes. He reached in, and one after the other, pulled out Inej's little leather slippers. Her face broke into a dazzling smile. Finally, a bit of luck. Kaz didn't have his cane, Jesper didn't have his guns, and Inej didn't have her knives, but at least she had those magic slippers. What do you say, Wraith? Can you make the climb? I can. Jesper took the shoes from Wylan. If I didn't think these might be crawling with disease, I would kiss them and then you.
24. Nina. Nina trailed Kaz up the stairs. Flight upon steep flight of stone and flickering gaslight. She watched him closely. He was setting a good pace, but his gait was stiff.